Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, Paul Ryan on how to help the poor, both parties on what to do about small business, and Stephen Beard on the fate of the London taxicab. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 24th of October, E-Day minus 13, if you're counting, which we all are, of course. Paul Ryan was out campaigning today, as could be expected, in Ohio, as could also be expected. The subject matter, though, was something of a surprise. Poverty, how best to end it and help people get out of it. It was a surprise because neither party has said a whole lot about the poor this election season. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji has the story.
In his speech, Paul Ryan said low-income Americans need access to good education, a strong safety net.
But above all else is the pressing need for jobs.
Everyone agrees with that. I don't think that's a controversial statement.
Robert Greenstein runs the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
When in the late 1990s we had 4% unemployment, we had significant reductions in poverty.
Here's where the controversy comes in.
The real debate is about whether they are best met by private groups or by the government.
They, meaning the needs of the poor. Melissa Boteak at the Center for American Progress says private charities play a role, but
if the Romney-Ryan plan for nutrition assistance were to go into effect, every church in the United States would have to raise $50,000 a year for the next 10 years just to replace the food assistance that would be cut from families struggling the most to make it in this economy.
Boteak says safety net programs like food stamps are designed to expand during rough economic times when private sector donations dry up. But Nick Schultz, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, says government benefits like food stamps need to be paid for, and that means taxes.
That's then money that businesses can't use to grow and to grow the economy, or individuals can't use to give to their churches, to give to charitable organizations.
Paul Ryan said finding that balance between the private sector and government will require a bold departure from current policies. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji from Marketplace.
If there's a word or a phrase that's been said less than poverty in this campaign, it might well be this. Climate change. It came up exactly zero times in any of the debates. But something interesting happened while nobody was looking. U.S. carbon emissions, greenhouse gases, that is, are falling. A new projection says they're going to drop almost 17% by the year 2020, which is, as it happens, the promise that President Obama made at the Copenhagen Climate Summit 3-something years ago. So how did that happen? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
You and I have a shrinking carbon footprint. How? Let's go through your day. You start your car and there's a big contributor. Cars are guzzling less due to mileage regulations and shopping preferences, says an author of the study, Dallas Bertraw, at Resources for the Future.
A new car built about a decade from now will be twice as energy efficient as one built and sold around 2010.
You get to work, flip on the switch, and LED lights.
The improvement in efficiency of lighting has contributed substantially to reduce the energy use in the home.
Behind that switch is a power plant, and chances are it's burning more cheap natural gas than coal. Biggie. Now, the new emissions study also assumes more EPA rules on power plants, and those are uncertain, says Elliot Dieringer at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions.
The variables here are the stringency of the regulation, the pace of regulation, and how readily EPA can fend off legal challenges.
So a 16 or 17% cut is far from a sure thing. And, of course, warming is global, reminds Rick Piltz at Climate Science Watch.
If you eliminated all of the emissions from the industrialized Western countries and didn't do anything with the developing countries, that would be enough to push global warming past a dangerous tipping point.
At the very least, the U.S. hitting its target could put some planetary peer pressure on other countries. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders were a little bit off their feed. Anybody else forget there was a Fed meeting today, by the way? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. ¶¶ The numbers in the grand scheme of things are small, but every presidential election cycle, there's more than a handful of people in this country who, if their guy doesn't win, threaten to move to Canada. They're joking, mostly. Lauren Chulgen explains it's not that easy to actually pack up and move. It's not that cheap either.
Hannah Frame will be watching the upcoming election very closely from her dorm at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. The outcome of the election doesn't just affect her politically. It could have major ramifications for the rest of her life.
I don't want to live in a country whose fundamental policies I disagree with.
Frame says she's worried if Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney wins, it could mean the end of the Affordable Care Act. It could mean more draconian immigration policies. And these are all issues she feels very strongly about. Now, she's not saying she would head north on November 7th. She'd like to finish out college here, and she's got three more years to go. But from the sounds of things, she's pretty set on living in a place that thinks and acts like she does.
Especially being from Michigan, Canada's right across the border. It's not super far from home for me.
You can't just up and decide, you know what, I'm going to move up north and pack my bags.
Michael Nieren is a managing partner of Nieren and Associates Immigration Lawyers in Toronto. Nieren will tell you straight up, immigrating to Canada is not easy.
A lot of people are shocked and surprised that they have to go through great expense and a lot of bureaucratic hurdles to make it.
First up, Nieren says government fees for Canadian residency applications start as high as $1,500, even more if your spouse or kids are moving with you. And if you want a lawyer like Nieren's help, it's going to be another few thousand dollars. There are lots of different routes to becoming a Canadian citizen. If you're a single working American who just wants out, for example, Nieren says they'll ask you lots of questions. Not a lot of job experience? Your application gets marked down. Over 40 years old or have a bad medical history, your application gets marked down. Criminal background, your application gets marked way down. And when it's all said and done, Canada just might not want you.
The government wants to ensure that people who come to Canada contribute to the economy, who will make an impact, a positive impact in Canada, economically or culturally.
No matter how difficult the process, somewhere between 7 and 10,000 Americans become permanent residents of Canada each year, according to government numbers. But it's opportunity, not politics, that's luring them there, says Dimitri Papadimitriou, president of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C.
It is, you know, the opportunity to actually grow in your job, opportunities for your family and children, you know, a system that seems to work, social protections that make sense. All of those things enter into the mix.
And he says for some Americans, the state of the U.S. economy makes the grass in Canada really seem much greener.
The fact that Canada was not hurt almost at all, or at least not in a significant way, by the crisis in 2008. You put all of those things together and you find most of the explanation.
But he says for many Americans who make the move, it won't really be a permanent thing. Once they advance their careers, they often return to the U.S. So what does all this mean for people like Hannah Frame, whose motivation for a move to Canada is political?
Obviously, moving is a huge hassle, but I'm going to be setting up a new home, and I want to set up a home somewhere I feel comfortable. And for me, I think it would be worth it to set up in Canada.
But she says if it doesn't work out, California could be an option. It's still pretty progressive, and she's heard the weather's better there, too. In Chicago, I'm Lauren Chulgen for Marketplace.
How much did you get for allowance when you were a kid? Assuming you got allowance, that is. 50 cents a week, maybe? A buck, maybe? According to the American Institute of CPAs, the average allowance nowadays, get this, is $65 a month. That's almost $800 a year, which creates something of a bookkeeping problem. A slew of online startups has figured out a solution. They're creating virtual banks managed by parents and their kids. Dan Bobkoff has today's installment of our series Money Matters, all those things that hit us in the wallet no matter how old we are. Here's Dan.
The bank of mom and dad can be an unreliable place. Forget FDIC insurance. If you're a kid, getting your money out can be a challenge. Just hear the plight of 8-year-old Michael Skivara's friend, Simon.
Simon, he's saying his mom always forgets, so like every 5 weeks he gets like $2.
Michael doesn't have that problem. His parents are on top of things.
Ooh, you went to the Giants game. What did you get there?
On his mom, Suzanne's laptop is a site showing her kids' spending and savings in intricate detail. There are pie charts. Each week, Michael and his brother get an allowance.
$7 each week.
It gets virtually deposited into virtual accounts on the site, and the kids get to decide how much to spend, save, and donate. Then, when they want something, their mom is prepared.
We might be in the toy store, and the boys start saying, I want this, I want this. And it's like, okay, it's up to you. You have an allowance. And so I'm able to pull out the iPhone and go, okay, you actually only have $6 in your account right now. I don't think you're going to be able to pay for it.
Suzanne Skivara and her family live north of San Francisco. On the virtual banking site she uses, her kids even earn interest.
5% per month.
Where can I get that? Since these accounts are virtual, parents still have to keep the money on hand. Analysts say the sites are unlikely to take off until they're tied to parents' real accounts. Only 1% of kids save any of their allowance. Can these allowance trackers teach good habits? Beth Kobliner is skeptical. She's the author of Get a Financial Life, and she says these sites could ultimately lead kids to spend more.
Every day, going online and checking, gee, you know, how much money do I have now? And, oh, here are all the great things I can buy.
Most of these sites either charge their parents money or have tie-ins with stores like Amazon. And Kobliner worries that by reducing an allowance to numbers on a screen, kids won't experience the pain of spending cold, hard cash. But at least their parents won't forget to pay up. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think a few people walked out on the premiere at the Fargo Theater because of the violence. You know, it was not everyone's cup of tea, as you might say.
No, it wasn't. What the city of Fargo thinks about the movie Fargo. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 25 points today, almost 0.2%, finished at 13,077. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points, 0.25%, 2981. The number of the S&P 500 slid 4 points. 0.3%, settle at 1408. Yeah, so the Fed met today. No change in anything, but they met. Gotta tell you. Netflix surrendered nearly 12% today. The company slashed its projection for new subscribers. AT&T declined almost 1%. Drug maker Eli Lilly swallowed more than 2.5% after reporting lower profits. And Bristol-Myers Squibb stock fell more than 0.5% today. News, its earnings slipped because of the competition from generic drugs. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for September. Sales of stuff like refrigerators and car parts, things that should last you more than 3 years. First Lady Michelle Obama is scheduled to make an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And if that's not enough TV for you, add the World Series into your schedule. Game 2 is tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just when you thought things couldn't get any worse for Barnes & Noble, this happened. Somebody hacked the debit and credit card swipe terminals at 63 of its stores. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Barnes & Noble has not released any information on exactly how its swipe machines were hacked. We know that only one machine at each of 63 stores around the country was compromised.
But if past breaches are any indicator, it was almost certainly an inside job at some level.
Brian Krebs is an investigative reporter who covers cybersecurity. Krebs says that hacks like these can happen one of two ways. One is at the factory where the devices are made. The criminals can either install malicious software or hardware can be inserted directly into the device before it's shipped.
Or they're compromised by employees or contractors, and they might be employees of that retail chain, or they may be employees of the company that the chain uses to service those card readers.
Barnes & Noble declined to comment, citing an investigation by the FBI. As part of the investigation, all 7,000 keypads at Barnes & Noble's across the country have been shut down.
So I expect these attacks to continue because the system in America is broken.
Kevin Mitnick is a former hacker turned security consultant. He says these types of scams are simple to pull off. They're hard to detect.
And the profits are huge. I mean, we're talking about wholesale interception of credit card numbers, debit card numbers and PINs, which translate directly to money at an ATM machine.
So what can you do to protect your debit card before you swipe it? Not much, other than checking your monthly statement for any unauthorized charges. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
The British Empire disappeared 60 years ago, but another icon of English superiority has endured. The London taxicab, black, roomy, expertly driven, but not for much longer, perhaps. The company that makes them has filed for the British equivalent of Chapter 11. From the streets of London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Taxi! Taxi!
It's as much a part of the London landscape as Big Ben. The unique shape has endeared the cab even to the men that drive it, like Gary Ridgewell.
And it's what people, Americans and other people, look for. When they're looking for a taxi, they're looking for this shape.
But pop the hood and the black cab and the company that makes it don't seem quite so hot. CEO John Russell.
What really hit us hard was the downturn after the financial crisis, and that saw our volumes drop to a half.
Barely 1,500 vehicles a year. And then the last straw, a recall.
We discovered we had a safety-related problem with the steering box on the vehicle.
But critics of the company say the real steering problem is in the boardroom.
It's been an extremely badly run and managed company.
Jonathan Myers represents cab drivers. He says they've endured poor service from the London taxi company for years, but he's now hoping for better things. The Chinese company that bought Volvo also owns a 20% stake in the British cab firm.
What we're hoping is that they will buy the company and put a Volvo engine in it and start treating cab drivers with dignity.
The London taxi company says it would welcome an American partner, but it's now really trying to hail any passing investor.
Taxi! Taxi!
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, a story about what you find when you try to get past the politics of this economy. Much has been made this election cycle about taxes. About taxes on upper-income people in particular, and what raising those taxes would mean for small businesses. President Obama says people making more than $250,000 a year could afford to pay a little bit more. Governor Romney says that would hurt job creation, hiring by small businesses. But as often happens with electoral politics, when you start asking around, you find the answer isn't quite so clear, as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explains.
Joe Felt has been a small business owner for most of his career.
I own a small construction company in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Employed 10 people a few years ago. Since the real estate crash, it's down to just Joe. Meanwhile, across the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, Joe has a friend, Sean Sheely, who owns a small business too. 4 employees in web design.
We build apps, websites, interactive installations.
In a lot of ways, Joe and Sean are a lot alike. Entrepreneurs, Twin Cities locals, even their hobbies.
This is Joe. Let me just put it this way. Neither of us are probably ever going to play golf. We are pretty aggressive and we like to play really hard.
Specifically, Sean explains,
riding motorcycles together, dirt biking.
So one day, recently, Sean called Joe asking if he was free that night to work on a motorcycle they're restoring together. Joe said,
that would be great, but there's only one problem. I'm going to be streaming the debate.
The presidential debate.
Knowing that this could be, you know, kind of an interesting situation.
Interesting because...
This is Sean. I'm certain I'll vote for Obama.
And Joe?
I will definitely not be voting for Obama.
That's right. Strange as it may seem, given how often small businesses are talked about this election cycle as if they're one monolithic block, not all small businesses or their owners are alike. Even if they both ride dirt bikes. So to say your policies are going to be small business friendly, what does that really mean? Let's break it down a little, starting with taxes and Obama's proposal to raise them on incomes over 250K. Sean says he hopes he has a good enough year that a policy like that would actually affect him. He also says it would be an incentive to expand his business.
If you tell me that if I make more than $250,000 a year that I'm going to pay a higher tax, I'm more inclined to plow that money back into the business and hire people so that I can effectively have a lower tax rate.
And Sean says if he did get charged an extra $10,000 or so in taxes,
I don't see that hindering me hiring or changing the way that I would do business. But what is that point?
Joe has to jump in here. He worries higher taxes could hinder small business owners, crush their entrepreneurial spirit.
The tax percentage goes to a certain point and people are going to say, it's no longer worth it. Why don't I just take the money that I have earned and just invest it in something a little more benign and go sit on my boat off of Key West and drink gin and tonics?
That's not the only thing that bugs Joe about tax hikes. Joe points to his wife. She's in the military. Recently, the government flew her to Wisconsin and put her up in a hotel for the weekend, all so she could attend a training session for 6 hours.
A six-hour PowerPoint presentation. We're probably looking at somewhere around the $2,000 range to make this all happen. That's tax dollars that could have been spent other places.
That's why Joe's voting for Romney, he says, because as a businessman, he'll be inclined to cut that kind of waste. But now it's Sean's turn to jump in.
Well, but he's not proposing any cutting any waste. I mean, he's not talking about cuts at all. He's talking about spending more money.
Well, the perfect candidate is not running. Well, actually, there is no perfect candidate. I just think that the direction that he will head is more the direction I would like to see the country go.
The one thing Joe and Sean do agree on, both are actually kind of sick of all the attention small business owners like them are getting this fall. As Sean puts it,
it's the new kissing the baby. The conversations around small business, I feel, are pandering.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
And in a heated election year like this one, Joe and Sean say maybe it's safer to leave it at that and get back to their motorcycles.
We just decided to quit arguing, or I decided to go, so.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Fans of the Coen brothers and their offbeat movies, Raising Arizona and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, just two of them, are in for a treat. 16 years after its original release, their funny and completely disturbing film Fargo is going to be turned into a television series on the FX network. Fargo took home a couple of Oscars and firmly established that city's name in our collective psyche in a maybe not so good way. Charlie Johnson is the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau. Mr. Johnson, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So it's been, what, like 15 years now since this movie, right?
Yeah, 1996, I think it came out, right?
Still working for you guys?
It seems to be. We have the actual wood chipper that was in the last scene of the movie.
No way. Do you really?
It's in our visitor's center, and we have a mannequin leg sticking out of it.
Oh,
it's autographed by the Coen brothers, and thousands of people every year stop and get their picture taken with it. We give them a little wood chipper kind of hat, you know, an ear lapper, and everyone seems to like it still. So the movie still has some sort of cool factor about it.
I'll tell you what, that wood chipper scene still gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, it is kind of weird, isn't it? Well, you could come and relive it, Kai. Come on out to Fargo.
No, thanks. I'll pass. and now the Coen brothers are going to make a TV show based loosely, I understand, on this movie, right?
Right, and you probably know about as much about it as I do, although I did try to call their production office after I heard that it had apparently been okayed for FX. Obviously, we'd love for them to shoot some of it around Fargo, you know, or in northern Minnesota where it originally took place.
Yeah, it's worth a mention that the movie actually was set in Brainerd, Minnesota, right?
Right. Actually, the only scene in the movie that supposedly takes place in Fargo is the very first scene. You know, it opens and he's driving, William H. Macy's driving down the road towing that burnt umber Sierra, and he's got it to the bar, and he meets these two guys. The bar where he meets the two killers is supposedly in Fargo. The rest of the movie all takes place in the Twin Cities and around Brainerd.
Now, were you in Fargo when this movie came out?
I've been in Fargo forever, pretty much, Kai.
So what was the reaction? I mean, were people pleased, offended, what?
Well, I think at first they were pleased that there would be a movie called Fargo, but then when it came out, there were some mixed reactions, I think it would be fair to say, in the community. I think a few people walked out on the premiere at the Fargo Theater because of the violence. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not everyone's cup of tea, as you might say.
Yeah.
But as the movie seemed to gain cachet, I think people kind of warmed to the idea of it wasn't such a bad thing for the community. And in fact, it kind of put the town on the map, you know.
Has it paid off for you in terms of tourism revenue and all that?
You know, that's really a hard one to pin down. You know, all I can tell you is that thousands of people, as I said, get their picture taken with that wood chipper in our in our visitor center every year. I can't say how many of them actually came just for that reason, but I think most of them don't want to miss it once they find out it's there. And there's a festival in town that happens every fall called Fargo Fest, and it's actually built around the movie, and they show the movie outdoors on the wall of the biggest building in town, which is the Radisson Hotel. And it's kind of gotten to be kind of a big deal.
And it's a good old time, I bet. Charlie Johnson, he's the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau, talking to him about Fargo, possibly the television show. Mr. Johnson, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
As final note today, some news. First and then a question. The Justice Department sued Bank of America today. It wants $1 billion in damages for what prosecutors call brazen mortgage fraud. It says Countrywide Financial, which B of A bought in 2008, cranked out bad home loans without proper checks to make sure that they were legit, and then, to top it off, sold those mortgages to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the Justice Department says B of A kept on doing it after it bought Countrywide. So $1 billion in damages sought. It gets us to this question. Which was worse in the long history of mergers and acquisitions in this country? B of A, Countrywide, or AOL, Time Warner? Take your time. Think about it. Let us know. In the meanwhile, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 25 points, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points, almost 3-tenths percent. The S&P 500 decreased 4 points, 3-tenths percent there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.